This episode of the Troxel Podcast is made possible with support from ArcIT. Are you tired of standard IT services that miss the mark? Choose ArcIT for specialized, proactive IT management, BIM support, and robust data security tailored for architects. Whether you're a team of 10 or a growing firm of 50 plus, ArcIT understands the architecture industry and will empower your unique creative vision to enable you to do your best work. Embrace a technology team that enhances, not hinders, your design process. Visit getarcit.com for your free IT assessment and start transforming your firm and your tech experience today. That's getarcit.com. Welcome to the Troxel Podcast. I'm Evan Troxel. In this episode, Jim Walker of Ellis Don joins me to illuminate and discuss the systemic problems plaguing the construction industry. And of course, construction isn't alone, but we'll get more into that in today's conversation as well. Jim brings over 20 years of experience in general contracting and project management across North America, from his early beginnings sweeping floors at construction sites to working for major firms like PCL and Ellis Don. Our conversation highlights the industry's evolution towards digital transformation, increasing complexity, and yet in many ways, inefficiency. But more importantly, we discuss the concept of construction being sick, the adversarial nature of traditional contract models, toxic work environments, health issues among workers, the value of blue-collar work in the trades, pros and cons of different project delivery models, risk and reward, and more. Overall, this episode encapsulates a critical analysis of the construction industry's challenges and potential paths forward through innovation and systemic change. So, now without further ado, I bring you my conversation with Jim Walker. Jim, welcome to the podcast. Great to see you again. It's been a little bit since we hung out last, but we've met up at a couple of AUs at the, what is it, the Yardbird, and that's kind of our gathering spot.
That's our watering hole.
Our watering hole, to have some food and some drinks. And last time we were there, you said something that has stuck with me. When we were kind of, we weren't even outlining this show. We were just talking about the industry. And you said, construction is sick. And I am really intrigued to kind of get into that today with you, because you are on the C side of AEC, but obviously you're involved in all of it. But before we talk about why or how construction is sick, tell me about you. Tell the audience about where you're coming from, what your trajectory has been, and where you're at in the industry today.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Jim Walker, as you'd mentioned. I'm currently working for a general contracting firm. We're making a push to open that presence here in the province of Quebec in Canada. I started in construction basically when I could walk. Like, I'm from a family of general contractors. And so I've been on job sites. You know, like, my first experience on a construction site was I got my driver's license 3 months after my birthday, and then summer vacation happened in high school. And it was, okay, you're going down the 401 to sweep floors on a job site. So, like, at 16 years old, I was getting exposed to construction. And so I started as a superintendent working in the family business for close to 9 years. And then my father was nearing retirement age. My brother and I just weren't old enough to take over a construction company at that point or experienced enough. So he closed down his business. His clientele was all retiring as well. And went to work for a large general contracting firm North America-wide called PCL. I'm sure lots of people have heard that name. So worked at PCL for almost 15 years. And then 2 years ago, joined, going on my third year here now, joined a company called Ellis Don, so more of a Canadian-based general contracting firm. In that time, so it's over 20 years that I've been in, around, working through construction. Like, I've seen many sides of the business. You know, I've been on the $1 million and less size projects. I've been on the, you know, approaching $1 billion size projects. I've been around the industry as it's sort of gone through this, we could call it a digital transformation, even though it's not quite yet a digital transformation, and seen sort of the industry change from when, you know, like, your first priority when you set up your job site was, where do you put your trailer? And then where do you connect your physical phone line and your fax machine, because that's an important link to the outside world, to now where, like, you don't even consider that. Like, you need power, and then you hotspot off your phone to set up the job site. So I've seen sort of things go from being very unconnected to a very connected construction site, you know, in a construction environment. And, you know, the promise through all the years was that as things get more connected, they're supposed to get easier and faster. And kind of what I'm seeing is that things are just getting,
my head.
Yeah, things are just getting harder and more difficult, and people seem to argue more. And, you know, like, I lament for the good old days where, like, you know, two people could arrive on a site in the morning, come up with a plan, and then execute, well, maybe not that morning, but execute on a plan that they had made together that was sort of informal, but it was very efficient, and then arrive at the end of the day or at the end of the project and realize what they set out to do and walk away. And, you know, the work was done with good quality. The work was done according to the intent and the drawings and the plans and specs that the project team was given. And then it was, okay, let's leverage this relationship and move on to the next one and
yeah,
keep having fun at this.
Yeah. And so you're talking about some symptoms that we see on the outside, right? You see it, you live it probably every day, all day long. But the underlying sickness, I think, is what we want to get into today, because and it's not a surprise. So the clickbait headline, construction is sick. It's not surprising because we see the symptoms. We see people talking about the symptoms. We talk about labor shortages, supply chain issues. Like, these are, again, I think very surfacey kind of symptoms.
Yeah.
But you have some particular insight into, like, what's really going on. And because I think those really are just at the surface. And we do need to dig deeper so that people understand the depth of the issues here, the depths of the challenge, the depths of the problem. So let's get into it. I'm excited to have this conversation because it is really going to, I think, take it to a deeper level for the audience of this show to understand what's really going on at the handoff point from design to construction, right? And what happens at that point, and what are we dealing with? Because I think what this will ultimately do is help, I would hope, us on the design side of that make some adjustments to make that make that easier, make that better. And I know we can't affect all of it, right? Because there's some very serious issues that you're going to get into here. But maybe some of it can be addressed by taking a cross section through all of AEC and really understanding the underlying issues here, because we've got our own problems too that we're dealing with. There is sickness in architecture as well. But let's talk about construction. So, what are the systematic issues in the construction industry that are really underlying? And like, give us a place to start this conversation.
Yeah. So, I mean, system, that word right there is probably the best place to start, right? And so a lot of times I find that we view our industry in sort of silos. Like, you have the design, you have the execution, and then closeout. And there's no sort of understanding of the interrelation between all of those. We try, you know, we sort of orbit around the answer, but we never get right down into the meat. And that, like, that root cause causes all these other things. You know, you talk one there about labor shortage. Like, to me, labor shortage is tied to this the sickness that we create in the industry. Where we sort of kicked off our conversation last time we were talking, right, was about walking the floor at Autodesk. And we were sort of looking at all of these vendors that are promising, like, to make it so that the plumber doesn't install the pipe in the wrong spot. And, you know, I gotta say, like, when I hear that as like the pitch, it sort of like closes me down right away, because I can tell you, there's the plumber doesn't install the pipe in the wrong spot. If you trace it back to the root cause, there's either a misunderstanding of where the pipe should have been, there was a conflict in some document somewhere, there was maybe a misunderstanding on what the client wanted, and there was a change of the document somewhere down the road which caused a misalignment. But like, to solve where the plumber puts the pipe is solving the problem at the wrong point in the system. Like, you have to go further upstream in order to really, right, have a valuable solution to it. But it doesn't stop there, because the sickness then becomes, it's like, you know, you have all of these people that go to work in the construction industry every day, and nobody, like, I honestly believe nobody's getting up in the morning thinking to themselves, oh, today I'm going to do a bad job. Like, everybody's getting up in the morning thinking they're going to do a good job, but that alignment of what it defines a good job is different. And so those differences in alignment create this tension and this toxicity on a construction site. And it's not just on the construction site, it's in the offices that support the construction project that it also happens. And so what is the sickness? Well, you know, we're talking about like higher instances of heart disease. Like, I'm sure, you know, the smoking construction worker stereotype, like, you don't have other industries that have that same sort of, you know, stereotype associated with it, right? But that there are a lot of smokers. There's a lot of alcoholism and substance abuse. Like, the majority of fentanyl deaths in North America are associated with people in the construction industry.
Wow.
Suicide, like all of these like really big health problems that make our people sick, I believe are all associated with the environment that we put people to work on in a construction site. It's uncollaborative, it's toxic, it's argumentative. You know, and it's part of like, you know, going from when you just had the fax machine, and if you were going to write a letter to somebody, you had to like type it out, then print it, proofread it, write a cover letter for the fax, and then fax it to someone, versus, you know what, that's just too much of a pain. I'm just going to call the person and air my grievances and sort it out. But now, like, you can create these emails that you can sit down, write it out in a fury, send it off, then somebody else responds, and it's just this cycle of like, well, you did this, and you did
piling
this.
On. Right.
Yeah, piling on. And what happens at the end of the day? Like, where does that tension and stress, where does it all go? Well, in some instances, it goes into, you know, escape through the form of substances and
coping mechanisms, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, those root issues are really interesting, because you brought back kind of the imagery in my mind of what was it like maybe in the 70s on a construction site. We see these old construction site photos with the guys on the skyscraper beams as the steel primary steel's going up in New York City. And I think about that kind of imagery still to this day, even though, you know, we're going through this quote unquote digital transformation, right, of the construction site. And so, like, is it just because old habits die hard? Is it really because of the older generations in the construction industry who really like embodied that kind of visual that I'm thinking of, and it's proliferating on? Because I can tell you that's what's happened a lot in architecture, right? Which is like, no, you're going to sit at your drafting board for 12 plus, maybe 16 hours a day, because you have to dedicate your life to architecture. And the studio environment that we went to school in, everything revolved around the design studio. Everything played second fiddle to the design studio. The design studio was always the most important thing in your entire life. In fact, you need to give up the rest of your life for these 5 years while you're in school, because it's so important. And it's training grounds for what it's going to be like. And I'm using my podcasting air quotes here, of what it's going to be when you actually get into the industry. And in many cases, it is, because we're pre-programmed to believe it is like that. And then the previous generations are operating like that as well, and have expectations that you have to do it the same way that they did, right? You're going to have to pay your dues. You have to go through the same struggles and trials and tribulations that they did. You have to work your way up the ladder, and it takes a lot of time, and there's no immediate like metrics of measuring any of that. So you know where you are in the system. And so I could go on and on, obviously, about this. And I imagine you have a version of that in construction.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Right. Like, you have to, you know, if you're a superintendent, and even to some extent, like, you know, the project manager, like you have to do your time in the field. And I think that, you know, doing your time in the field is important, because you have to, especially from the general contracting sphere, like, you have to understand what you're planning and what you're trying to set out to build, which is, I'm sure, the same, you know, for in the architectural field. Like, you have to have an understanding of how to draw things, how to bring them together and coordinate them. I'm not an architect, right? So like, maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but like, you know, that when you're not physically drawing something, and similar to, if you're not like picking something up and learning with your hands, as well as your eyes, as well as reading, like you don't sink into the information as much sometimes, it feels like it. So in this age of like digitization, like, we're not coordinating with shop drawings as much as we used to. And I think it's also a function of like architects' time is being squeezed so much in this race to the bottom, right? Like, you don't take the time. Does the door frame work with the tile that's going to go on the wall to create the reveal that is intended? Or does it mess up the elevator lobbies, the entire height of a 30-floor office tower, right? Like, just because that understanding of the shop drawing of the elevator throat, the elevator door frame throat, wasn't understood. Mm-hmm. I drew it on a drawing. It's digital. I got it there. Like, I pulled the icons down and I made it work. And I
checked the boxes. Right.
That's right. And then the plumber installed the pipe in the wrong spot because it sticks out of the wall now. Well, No, it's just we didn't take the time to understand what everybody needed and where everybody's needs were, let's say, to, for lack of a better term, when it came to coordinating the details and making sure tolerances lined up and things aligned.
You talk about the squeeze, right? The architect's time is getting squeezed. And I would actually position it that, or posit that, we are incentivized to spend less time on everything. And I'm coming at this from a large firm perspective, because that's my experience when I was working in design and production. There, it was like, go faster, go faster, go faster, right? And go faster means do less. That's actually what it means, right? Mm-hmm. So yep. To your point about lack of coordination and understanding the weight of a material or how two materials actually go together, not just taking a Revit detail component and slapping it up against another Revit detail component and saying that's how they go together, because it's not, right? Like that's just a graphic representation of what you want the outcome to be. It's not necessarily how it works, right? And when you talked about the importance of, you know, superintendents and project managers on construction sites having site time, having experience on construction projects to get to those levels, it's the same thing for architecture, but we spend literally close to zero time out on the site. There are a few people who do construction administration who go to the site meetings, right, and work through those issues. Their digital process, the phone, the email, whatever, is sending problems back to the production team to solve in drawing format. And really, those two things don't ever meet in the middle. The production teams don't get to go to the site and actually learn what the lines they're drawing mean when it comes to, in the real world, physical world getting built. They don't have the time, and because the incentive again isn't there. Like, okay, now the firm's got to pay for your time, got to pay for your mileage, right, to do that. Who knows how far away from the borders of a firm are expanding, because competition is getting more and more fierce all the time, and so they're trying to cover more area. And that just means the projects are farther away. And now we got to spend even more time to go do that. So what are we going to do? We're going to send less people. We're going to send one person once a week to the construction meeting, right? So,
with no mentoring, with no sort of,
like, because you can't send two people. You can't send the person who's been there, done that, along with the new person who's learning it on the way. It's a, and I think what's interesting about all this is we just expect it to still work. Right? Like the expectation is that people are getting mentored. It's that they are gaining experience. And what they are gaining experience through failure, because they have to, as they learn things on the way. But often that failure is like, those are the very expensive mistakes. And it's happening too late in the process, rather than this proactive relationship building mentoring process. No, it's like, no, we're going to learn by mistakes.
And it'd be be defensive when we do make mistakes. And both, like, look at, let me be very clear
finger
here.
Pointed,
right? Like,
right?
Yeah, I'm not trying to make hay on architects here by in this conversation. I hope that that's very clear. Like, I understand there's challenges in the architecture and engineering spheres as well as the building spheres. Like, I'm not, all that to say, I'm not trying to just point fingers here.
We all
have our challenges. Yeah, exactly. but yeah, like, right? Like, there's, If you make a mistake and somebody's there to support you through that mistake, or parties are there to support you through that, look, I get it. Like, mistakes happen. Let's work together and make this thing better, versus you made this better, now you're going to have to pay. Well, no, I didn't make, or sorry, you made a mistake, now you're going to have to pay. Well, no, hang on, I didn't make the mistake. If I go back through my emails, you made the mistake. And so now we're like focused on going through emails, generating waste for the construction system instead of focusing on solutions and generating value for the construction system. As a system, you know, and it's sort of like the notion, go slow to go fast. Like, take your time in design, and you know, and this ties into the contract model of the construction project. Take your time to understand the design. Take your time to understand the needs of the client. Avoid those RFIs and those SIs through the construction process, because those are waste. And if you drill down into the root cause of RFIs and SIs, I'm willing to go toe-to-toe that if there wasn't a change in scope, every SI can be drilled down into a root cause, as we didn't just spend enough time at the beginning of the project. And when I say we, I don't mean architects and engineers. I mean everybody involved in the construction process: client, consultant, builder, sub-trade, inspector, everybody didn't spend enough time in that front end. maybe we don't have enough time, but if we don't have enough time, then we have to realize that like this waste that we're generating is
yeah.
part of it. And when we sit through these presentations at you know, some of these events that you and I cross paths at, and they show that same graph where everybody else's efficiency is going up and construction's is going down. Well, let's not sit there and go, interesting. Like, we know why.
This episode is made possible with support from Avail. In a world where precision meets creativity, where every line drawn holds the power to innovate, people like you are shaping the future. But let's face it, in the realm of design, the unknown is your least favorite companion. You've been stranded on the island of inefficient software, lost in the fog of endless searching for the right content. It's time to embark on a new journey, a journey to clarity, efficiency, and design excellence. It's time to get off that island and away from the unknown. Introducing Avail, the beacon in your design odyssey. Say goodbye to the daunting 10 to 20 minutes wasted per search, the costly interruptions in your creative flow. With Avail, your team will zip through content discovery, focusing more on designing and less on searching. Imagine a world where you can stop constantly fighting the costly fires caused by pulling content from past projects, building from scratch, or relying on personal libraries. Avail isn't just a tool, it's a revolution for AECO firms. Organize, manage, and navigate your project information with a leader that's proven in reliability, relatability, and success. Join the ranks of the top AECO firms who've already chosen Avail. In just 30 days, you could deploy Avail and witness a dramatic reduction in costly design errors. Whether it's your first CMS or you're considering a switch, there's someone you should meet. Will Rouse, your guide to all things Avail. Schedule an appointment and explore Avail's capabilities, onboarding programs, and professional services. Don't let your designs be clouded by inefficiency. Clear skies are just a click away. Go to getavail.com/stranded and book a meeting with Will to start your Avail journey today. Avail, where your best design is just a search away. My thanks to Avail for supporting this episode of the Troxel Podcast. And now let's get back to the conversation.
Can you, just before we move on, define RFI and SI for those that don't know what those terms mean?
Yeah. So I know the term is different in some other jurisdictions, but sort of in the building sphere that I work in, like RFI is a request for information and SI is a site instruction. And you could have, you know, different terms to contemplated change. You know, there's all kinds of different terms that can be used interchangeably, but it's basically like we had a set of documents, we're changing those documents because something has changed and we're building something different now.
You know, I used to believe... I was just going to say another acronym for RFI that I've heard recently, which I think still applies, is room for improvement.
Totally.
It's like you could have made the document, you could have answered, and many times the answer is already in the documents, and so maybe that's outside of this conversation, but it's like the information that I need isn't there, right? And so I'm requesting information at the same time, like next time. Now you know like what I needed, and again, sometimes it already is in there and people just don't know where to look, but sometimes the information is not there and we have to be honest about that too.
Think of the data that's being generated in RFIs, right? Like if you take a large architectural firm, like how many RFIs have they been asked? How many of those RFIs are the same? But yet every construction project, like, okay, we got these 10 RFIs, these are what we got to ask.
Yep.
Right? Okay, well, why are we asking the RFI? Why isn't this being corrected at the outset? And you could probably drill in deeper into the data if you really had a good data set. Like, let's go from the perspective of the builder. Like, if I work with this architectural firm, I know that these details are going to be poorly coordinated. I know that these are the RFIs that are going to need to be asked because these are always the misses that this house, design house, always makes. All right, you know, and I'm sure with architects, you could say the same thing. Okay, with this builder, we know they're going to come at us with this RFI, and we know they're going to miss these things when we go and we do our sign-off inspections at the end. So like, why not use that data at the front end of the construction system to say, okay, guys, have we captured all this? Because we know working together, we always have these problems.
Well, I'll tell you why, Jim, right? We know this too. We know the answer to that, which is it's going to be a different team. The team makeup is going to be different on the next project because of availability in the design firm of those individuals on different projects. There's turnover on projects as well, right? In the offices. And then nobody has the time, again, we keep coming back to time, but to actually implement those lessons learned on the next project, because we're looking at the next project and the old project is done and out the door. It's in the archives. Moving on. Now we're going to do the next one. And that is a huge problem, is that, like, okay, we do learn through failure. We do learn through these challenges. We do come up with the solutions, and yet they do not get implemented back into the process. The feedback loop itself is also broken in most in most instances across the industry.
And this is my hope to where technology can really help the industry. It's not in making sure the plumber installs the pipe in the right spot. It's like, what are the 10 questions that we always ask on every project over $1 billion? Like, let's solve those for every project going forward. And then, like, boom, we've just made the system more efficient. And yeah, you're right. We don't have enough people to look at those every single project. Let's solve them once and for all. Because there are things that repeat. And whoever's listening who's from, like, a building side, like, you know what I'm talking about. Like, you always have, pick on door frames, but you always have door frame throat size RFIs that get asked on big projects, because it's always like a miss. It's, you know, you have two or three different disciplines coming together right there at a door frame, and it's always a tough spot. But, you know, going back to, like, not having, you know, going further back then in this thing that we don't have enough people in the industry, like, there's not enough people to do the work. It's like, well, we did it to ourselves. I mean, you've been in this industry as long as I have, right?
Like, you can see the gray hair.
There you go. but people started talking about labor shortage like 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Oh, the baby boomers are all going to retire. There's going to be a huge labor crunch. And what did we do? Oh, we need to put more people into it. We need to get more kids in trade schools and vocational schools and support the trades. Well, instead, high schools cut all the trade programs. But that's not addressing the root cause still. Like, the root cause is an image issue that the construction industry has. Mm-hmm. Like, if I'm sure, you know, you have friends who have children who have nothing to do with construction. And if you ask them, hey, why don't you encourage your 6-year-old child to pick up a trade and go into the trades, that I'm willing to tell you they would say no. And
it's about as popular as going into the military, I would think, right? It's one of those things where it's just not the kind of job that people aspire to, because parents and teachers have basically programmed everybody to aspire to going and working in a cubicle in an office, right?
That's right.
Becoming a knowledge worker, which actually means sitting in a 7x7 cubicle for 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day, every day, commuting to that job, right? And it's kind of crazy. I just recently had an interview with Mary Elizabeth Yarbrough from Autodesk, who runs the technology center, which they do a lot of R&D and hands-on stuff at the Pier 9 in San Francisco. And it's really like where the rubber meets the road. Like, Autodesk makes software, right? Mm-hmm. And they have a research department. But they also are highly invested in making real things at these technology centers. There's one in Boston. There's one in San Francisco. Yep. And the book came up. So I'll reiterate it here, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But it's called Shop Class is Soulcraft by Matthew B. Crawford. It's a fantastic book about the value of hands-on work. And so he kind of makes the distinctions between knowledge workers and tradesmen, right, as an example of, but the satisfaction that comes out of actually working with your hands is lost on several generations, right? And because you have to be a knowledge worker, you have to work at a think tank, you have to have a job in finance, or you have to become an architect and sit at a desk, sit behind a computer and stare at glowing screens for 20 hours a day, 18
God
hours
forbid.
A day, right? Like we're doing right now. Yeah. But that, so I'm glad you brought it back to the image problem, because I think that this is one of the main problems that we have. And what's funny is people who are in the industry who are trying to attract talent, aren't actually doing anything about it. They're just complaining about it, right? And so what are they actually doing to attract? What stories are they telling? What are they showing the young people of the next generation about what's attractive about coming and working and doing this kind of work. Instead, it's like we throw our hands up and it's like, I don't know what we're going to do. I guess we can't do anything. I guess we're just going to have to figure out better ways, right? The answer is offsite construction, or it's prefab, or it's modular. And it's like, no, those are just layers on top of the problem.
It's
like
downstream in the system.
The real problem is the image problem, I think, that you're talking about. And we have to figure out ways, and it applies to architecture too. That's why I say we, because leadership and architecture firms have the same challenge, right? They have to be a model of what the vision of what somebody could be is. And so you need representation, you need equity, you need all those things. So every person out there can see a version of themselves and where they could go with that and what they could do with that and what the challenges are that they could be solving and how it can change the world. And yet leadership has a hard time with that, I think, in many, many cases.
Yeah. So you go back to, you know, you can put all the trade schools in the high schools you want. You can put all the funding for college courses that you want. But if parents aren't going to encourage their kids to go into construction in some form, like, you're just not going to have an uptick in people using those resources that are there. And what's the image that any parent who isn't associated with the construction industry has of a plumber or a form worker or an electrician? Well, it's that stereotype, which doesn't really belong in our industry, because the reality is, you know, from the trade side, like, well, even construction as a whole, as an industry, like, what industries are left in the world where if somebody has an entrepreneurial spirit and they really want to go it alone, can with a relatively small budget go and start making a company on their own and grow that company if they really have the drive and the desire to go and build it into something? And they can build it into something which can be, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, like, very profitable. Mm-hmm. Like, that 7x7 cubicle, like, working in finance, like, you're not going to go and start your own finance firm on Wall Street working on the weekends and doing odd jobs after hours. Like, it's not going to happen. But like, in construction, you can do that. And we need to be encouraging that. We need to be showing people, hey, like, look, this is that stereotype you had is not how it actually is. But the only way we're going to do that is by actually changing the industry to pivot away from that. And when the statistics keep coming back that, you know, there's more deaths or more overdoses from fentanyl than any other industry in North America, well,
that's a red flag.
Let's start there. But why is that happening?
Building on top of another interview that I recently did, which I think comes out before this one too, so it's probably safe to talk about it here, which is the idea that every company is actually a media company in addition to what they do. Whether they're leveraging that or not is up to them, right? And so the going back to this idea of image and telling the story about what you can do as a contractor, a tradesperson, however you would slot into that, isn't happening at scale. And so what's happening then is we're allowing somebody else to tell our story. And that's probably not correct. That story that's getting out there is the story of the plumber is about the plumber's crack, right? They're making $150 an hour, right, on the weekend because somebody has an emergency and the only person that can solve that emergency is a licensed plumber, right?
So how do
contractors tell the story? How do architects tell the story about what the vision is of what you could do with those skills and with that information, with that knowledge, with that wisdom of having done it to better society, to change the world, right? To go back like to the highest level, you can actually do those things. Do you have to aspire to those levels? No, you don't. You can literally, like you said, be working on the weekends doing bathroom remodels, right? Mm-hmm. And making an impact in your community for your neighbors or for your clients. But it has to start somewhere. And those stories need to be told from the source, not from somebody else's idea of what that is. Like, architects have failed at this forever, right? We let HGTV tell our story of what design is. And now we complain that every client wants their project in 8 hours, right? Or they want it because they saw it, that they thought it could happen in a week because HGTV told them so, right? Mm-hmm. We're letting somebody else tell our story because we take no responsibility over being the media of our own profession. And I think I just want to throw this in here because I think this is an important part. We have to take that responsibility of telling our own story, especially those who really champion and have a passion for the thing that they're doing. Granted, there are a lot of people who work in AEC who are miserable, and they should not be the ones telling the story. There's a misalignment. Like, they probably shouldn't even be in the industry, or they should be working for a different company, or they should be starting their own company and cutting the misery part out of it. That could mean leaving altogether, right? But let the people who are passionate, I mean, this is something that I've been doing for 12 years now on ArcaSpeak podcast with my co-host Cormac Phelan, right? Like, we want to see the industry get better, and we're telling the stories inside the industry, maybe not outside of the industry. I don't think we have too many listeners who come from general public to learn about architecture from us, mm-hmm. because we talk about insider industry stuff, what people should be looking out for, what's great about it, what should you be avoiding. But that's appreciated at the student level for sure, because students go to their teachers, and their academic teachers who are career academics don't work in offices. They don't know what it's actually like. So they're getting a version of what architecture is from them. And now what they're getting is a version of that from people who have actually done it. And that's been incredibly rewarding for me to hear people give me that feedback. But also it's great for them because it's a look, it's a slice, it's a lens into the reality of what it's like to work in the profession. Are contractors doing that?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, like, there's the same TLC shows about construction, which
yes,
they don't really speak to the reality of what the industry is like and how dynamic and exciting and you know, every day you go to it, like, it's funny, right? Like, young people come to construction, and I'll often tell them, right, like, a lot of people are very change averse, but you have this weird culture and not weird, you have this different culture of people in construction that sort of gravitate to this industry that have an allergy to things not changing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you put people on a construction site and it's the same at the end of the day as when you went in the morning, like, people start getting, ooh, this isn't good. Like, there should be change. You know, tell somebody that, hey, look at this construction project's going to be like 2.5, maybe 3 years long. Like, once you hit that 3-year mark, people start like breaking out in hives and like, are you sure there isn't something else? Like, I need change. I need evolution. I need to work at one end of the city and then the other. Like, I need that comfort in that chaos that happens, that excitement in that chaos. And I use the term chaos loosely, but like that chaos and a little bit of the unknown that happens and having to plan it and figure it out and work together and bring, you know, group A together to solve this problem and then group B together to plan out the next step and then group C to make sure that group A and B can work together properly, right? Like, there's this evolution and this looseness of structure that a lot of people really enjoy. And yeah, that I don't think there's, I don't know how you would really capture that in a TV show for 30 minutes, well, 22 minutes of runtime, less commercials. But yeah, it's a tough challenge. But I think that, you know, the people that are talking about like trade schools and vocation schools and you know, like putting funding into that stuff also have to be looking at, well, what are ways that we can solve the image problem in construction? And I think the image problem in construction comes from the toxic workplace we create, which is in effect a cause of the contract that everybody is brought together under.
Mm.
And that, to me, is the root cause, is the solution to the core problem of the toxic culture that we have in construction, which is what is making everybody sick, which is what is driving people away, which is what is driving inefficiency and lack of collaboration. And a lot of the core issues stem out from that one spot.
But they say like attracts like. And so I would also, you know, in addition to what you just said about driving out, there is also an attraction to likeness, right? And so people who thrive on those toxic environments are attracted to come in and proliferate them, right? And the feedback loop continues when it comes to that, which doesn't get us to a better place. I've seen this happen so many times in architecture offices where there will be somebody in a leadership position or a senior position who is definitely a toxic person. How do you know? Because everybody talks about it behind their back, right?
Yeah.
people find ways to get off projects with those people. They say, I will never work with that person. And instead of the company addressing that behavior issue or that person as a problem and getting rid of them, they just shuffle people around. And they avoid that as long as possible. And that toxicity proliferates as long as it possibly can, because nobody wants to have a confrontational meeting to address the root issue. And so on the other flip side of that is there will be people who gravitate toward that, and they will learn from that, and they will become that person as well, because it does get results of its own kind that somebody thinks is good for them, right? To move up the corporate ladder, to look good on a project, to make their career go into what seems to look like a good place. And so I think that you're right on there, is that like it is driving out the good people, or yeah, it's never attracting them in the first place, but it's also building more people like that, which just makes this problem last even longer.
So you said a couple of things there that I agree with, right? Like, I mean, yes, bad managers, but I mean, bad managers can occur in any industry. I don't think that's a unique problem to,
right, absolutely,
to the AEC industry, but like attracts like, I think is key there. Like everybody that comes to work in construction in the morning, and again, I think I said this before, but I honestly believes they've come to work today to do a good job. And I believe that you surround yourself, and you know, we're surrounded by people in the industry that want to do a good job. The problem is how do you define what a good job is? And you know, to an architect on a construction project, it's looking after the best interests of XYZ architecture. Second thing is to realize a product for their client. So you look at a general contractor, you know, like number one is to maintain the life of the general contracting firm. And number two is to realize a product for the client. And then the same thing all the way down the chain, the plumber, it's to look after XYZ plumbing is number one. And then number two is to do the work that was contracted and provide a product that you're being paid for. But the problem is that priority number one in all those instances is different for everybody. It's always look after your own fortress first, and then the project is second. And you know, one of the things that we had talked about a couple of months ago was like, how can you change that in the contract? And you know, a couple of years ago, I happened upon the IPD contract model, and I'd executed I've executed projects in the IPD contract model. And the key way to simply look at an IPD project is you take everybody's definition of what a good job is, and you align it centrally on success of the project. Because without success of the project, you do not have success of the company. You do not have success of the individual. And you cannot have one party succeed where another fails. So all of a sudden, you have everybody then saying, wow, okay, I got to work together. We got to leverage everybody's mind in this room to be as efficient, productive, collaborative as possible, and profitable as possible, to make sure we all do a good job at the end of the day.
This episode is made possible with support from Confluence. Picture this: October 2019, Lexington, Kentucky, the birthplace of Confluence, a place where tech leaders, AEC product developers, and practitioners came together for three transformative days. It was more than a conference. It was a confluence of ideas, discussions, and unforgettable social experiences. Since then, over 200 attendees have experienced the magic of Confluence. I've had the privilege of being part of three of these remarkable gatherings, two in Kentucky and one in Orange County, each one a melting pot of learning, collaboration, and camaraderie around a topic shaping our industry. And now we're thrilled to announce the next regional Confluence event in April 2024 in the vibrant heart of New York City. This time, we dive deep into the realms of AI and machine learning, unraveling their mysteries and potentials in our industry. Are you interested in being part of this exciting journey? To continue the conversation? To shape the future? Visit the link in the show notes for more details. Confluence, where ideas flow, connections form, and the future of AEC technology is shaped, one conversation at a time. My thanks to Confluence for supporting this episode of the Troxel Podcast. And now, let's get back to the conversation.
And
so define IDP, so just so IPD? Everybody knows what that IPD, sorry, I always do that. Tell everybody what that acronym means, and then, because it is also different than design build, and maybe we can talk a little bit about the differentiation there. But I think we're seeing a lot more projects doing IPD and doing design build for reasons that are based on the things that you just said.
Yeah, IPD is integrated project delivery. So at its core is there's a shared profit pool, which is shared amongst the parties that sign on to the IPD contract. In Canada, it's a CCDC 30. There's some other contract models as well, but you have a shared profit pool, which is always at risk. So, you know, you go back to the example of the SIs being generated. A lot of times when there's an SI or a site instruction or a request for information generated in the construction component of the construction system, it's associated with cost. Architect issues a site instruction, general contractor prices the site instruction. Mm-hmm. It's a yes or no, and there's an additional cost to the contract, depending on the contract model. And in IPD,
there could also be a credit, potentially.
True. Yeah, you're 100% right. In the IPD model, is if there is an extra cost to the project, it comes out of that pool of profit that sits there. Mm. And, you know, there's gates to release it through. That's getting into the technicalities, but there's gates to release profit throughout the job, but it comes out of that centralized profit pool. So instead of, you know, the knee-jerk reaction on the builder side to be, oh, drawings aren't right, issue an RFI, drawings aren't right, but what can we do as a team to solve this problem with no cost and no time impact to keep things moving on and still realize the vision of the client? Because if you don't realize the value definitions and the value statements at the end of the job that you created at the start of the job, well, then there's a cost impact there. So it's not like you're trying to short circuit the client and deliver a less than optimal product. You still have to deliver the optimal product. The thing is, now you're leveraging everybody's brain power on site to be as efficient as possible and as profitable as possible and work together as a team.
Yeah, you're all on the same team. I was going to say, you're all on the same team. And it doesn't incentivize this kind of pitting people against each other, which is the traditional method of design, bid, build, right? And it's interesting, the whole design, bid, build delivery mechanism, right? Which is, as architects, we compete typically it's going to be based on lowest fee to do the project, which means we're going to spend the least number of hours, right? And you mentioned the words earlier, race to the bottom, right? This is it. And then we put that project out to bid. We take the lowest bidder, right? And that lowest bidder is often looking for holes in the documentation as much as they can because they need to make up for it because they really can't do it at the low bid that they provided. And it's like designed to fail is another way that I would say it, right? It's how can a person, an entity, an owner think that that's going to come to the best outcome. And yet, like, we have to do it in many circumstances. If it's public projects, if it's a school, I mean, it's because you're using the public's resources to build said project. And therefore, we want to make sure we're getting the best deal. But is it really the best deal, right? When it's actually causing these much larger issues, like on paper, you can see how people would think that this is the best deal. But in reality, it's actually creating these toxic environments, pitting these silos against each other to fight the whole way through. And are you really going to get a great project when there's just this constant battle the whole time? Is war the answer, right? It's like, because that's kind of what it is a lot of times. It's rare, and it does happen, that you do have good relationships through that process. But it is rare.
Well, you definitely can. It's just the IPD contract model. So it contracts those relationships into the construction system. You know, let's walk through an example. And, you know, it's something that repeats on every big job. Let's say you're building some kind of a theater or something where acoustic walls are very important. So you have very, very important top of wall, mm-hmm. sealant details, mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. But in the construction, what's the first thing that happens? Well, you'll either have like a ductwork trade or a plumbing trade come through and they'll slap all of their ductwork up in the ceiling and just, you know, first, I did it. I'm done. I'm out, guys.
Yeah, done and out. Right. That's right. The goal, right, is to be there earlier than somebody else because the problems ripple down. They don't ripple up. Right.
So what happened? Yeah. So what happens now? Well, now your drywall trade is forced to try to work around massive ducts that a lot of times are in corridors right up against walls where your sound, your STC rating. Right, is also important. And they're trying to seal the tops of walls and create a good product for the client and the end user at the end of the day. Only the system you're using has like put all of these sticks in the wheels of that system to realize that. Mm-hmm. So what happens then? Well, you come through and you start trying to do your sound testing and you know, across walls and like everything's failing. Well, it's failing because I couldn't get up to the top of the wall to seal it because the ductwork was there first. Yeah, but he was really fast. Why weren't you that fast? Yeah, but so what
problems
the experience,
on top of problems.
Yeah, yeah, the experience yeah. in the IPD environment then is that your H, like in this particular example, would be your HVAC trade and your drywaller in your sub trade meeting. They go away after the meeting and they talk amongst themselves. Hey, look, I want to be as quick as possible. Do you think I could do this component of the work? So do you think I could frame the wall and just do 5 feet of the drywall at the top, seal it, and then you come through afterwards and do all your duct work? That leaves me weeks afterwards to do board, tape, sand, all that other stuff. And I right. can take my time to do my work properly. You get free and unencumbered access to do your work, so you're as efficient as possible. Together, we don't have to come back and do rework. We deliver a better product for the client. Then everybody's happy. And we did it in less time than we originally scheduled because we were scheduling under traditional contract model delivery models where our metrics are quite inefficient. And according to the graph that we always get presented in the conferences that we go to, construction efficiency is tailing off. So, you know, it just works so much better. And then what happens at the end of the day? Well, everybody feels great because they went in, they did a good job that day. You know, that everybody worked together. It was really rewarding to
they're
to
ready
go and
to
collaborate.
Show up the next day, right?
That's right. And instead of hitting the bottle instead of going to the pub for pints after work or, you know, like hitting the bottle, you know what? I went for a walk. I went and watched the waves roll in on the beach because I was really happy and satisfied. And then the health benefits come along with that. And then all of a sudden we don't have all of this other stuff associated with our industry. And then maybe parents start seeing that, hey, you know what? Construction is actually a really great place to send my kids to encourage them to go for their careers. And then all of a sudden this labor shortage that we were talking about starts going away. I know I'm talking about, you know, like utopian blue sky, but what if, right? Like,
so here's the issue. I thumb through Instagram quite often and I see, have you seen these videos where people, it's a guy like, you know, he's just cut out the background and he's wearing his hard hat and his safety vest and his eyeglasses and he's watching like terrible shit go down, right? Just OSHA problems. It's like the guy on the ladder slipping off this and falling off that and the pouring this into that shouldn't go there. And it's just like one thing after another. And like, again, we're letting somebody else, it's a meme, right? And, but that is, those funny videos stick with people. And so when I've got a kid and I'm like, and if they show an interest in something, and that's my mental image of what it looks like to work in construction is like major, major fails, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think about the reality of, I love to build myself. I love to make things and I have a shop and I've got a lot of tools that I should do a better job at justifying my ownership of them. But it's one of those things where you have a new challenge. You have the opportunity of having a new challenge every day. And I think people who like to solve puzzles, construction's a great place to go do that. And you get to go to different locations and you get to be outdoors and you get to do all kinds of things that are very different than going and working in a factory or working in an office. And I think there's a lot of really great pieces to this that could be talked about and kind of going back to this image and then marrying that to this IPD process. I think is very interesting potential, right? To actually tell those stories. I think we tell those stories to potential clients, right? Because we want to show them that there is a better way of working or there is a different way of working. And there are advantages to getting the teams all at the same table and incentivizing them with the same profit pool so that they work together instead of adversarially. Right. And so we tell those to clients because we think that there's a higher chance that we might get that commission if they buy into that as well. But what are we doing beyond the potential clients? What are we doing to actually get this information out into the world at large to start to change perceptions about AEC and what it's like to deliver projects that do take literally years to do? Right. And these are the biggest projects on the planet. And they're difficult. They're extremely nuanced. There's different challenges every day. Just because you solved it here doesn't mean it's going to work over there on the next project. And But I think that's also attractive, right? And so it's like starting to tell those stories. I know there's people out there who are doing this. There's like Tyler Campbell. I see his posts on LinkedIn all the time. Construction Brothers podcast. He's doing a lot of media work for these companies. But I mean, this is the kind of thing that I think needs a lot of help. And it needs people like you who are passionate about the construction industry to come on a podcast like this and talk about it, about how it could be better, what is the vision of what it could be, and why that's something worth pursuing. But man, like the call to action here is we need a lot more of that.
Yeah, there's groups that are they're looking to do that. You know, Hanson Wade has a conference called Advancing IPD, and that, you know, that's they have a couple of different ones in the U.S. In Canada, like I'm a board member of the Integrated Project Delivery Alliance, who's a non-for-profit group whose sole mission is just educating the industry on IPD and IPD in Canada. There is, you know, especially in the province of Quebec, in the past 2 years, there's really been sort of I'm going to call it a groundswell, but that might be a little premature, but there's a bit of a groundswell among the client side, the public client side, to find a different way to do projects. And I know that, you know, our Department of National Defense, saw a systemic issue with the delivery of their projects, that, you know, they were over budget and over cost, and looked for a different way to deliver those projects, and was the first organization in Canada to execute a CCDC 30 contract. CCDC is like our documents, Canadian Construction Documents Corporation, or center that generates a lot of their standard contract models and things like that. So yeah, it was like a pretty big step on the side of the client. You know, it's interesting too about like the IPD contract model is when you're executing the project, like the metrics that you use to judge success sort of change. You know, in a traditional contract model, we're constantly using like rear looking metrics that occurred in the past that don't help you predict really if a problem is going to occur. Same thing sort of like with safety, right? With near misses, like, a lot of times near misses are considered a forward-looking indicator if there's going to be a bigger problem. But really, a near miss, for anybody that doesn't know, a near miss is like an accident that almost happened. It's severe enough to take note, but no property was damaged and nobody got hurt. So for example, you know, somebody walking along, a worker walking along a grade level, and then something falls off of an upper floor and lands, say a hammer or a wrench lands beside them. It didn't break anything. It didn't hurt anybody, but it's still significant enough that we stand up and we take notice. And we try to make changes to what we're doing so that something really severe doesn't actually happen. And you know, the other thing about like construction is sick. Like there's all, you know, besides mining, construction is the most dangerous industry to work in North America. So one of the metrics that you start measuring in an IPD project is like, do you feel like we were being collaborative this week? And then you ask these questions after every meeting that involves, you know, your tradespeople, your foreman, your even your architects, your engineers as a group. Like, do you feel we were collaborating? Do you feel like we upheld the values we set out to do? Do you feel like, and it's a lot of like feeling, do you feel these things? Do you feel bought in still to the purpose? And I first got turned on to this, even before IPD, this construction as a system, when I was doing some work at a past employer with a company out of the UK called Vanguard. And it was started by a gentleman named John Seddon, who said, like, any organization, look at what they're delivering in terms of a system. And so what we were trying to do is, if, you know, when you walk out on a site, ask any worker, what is the purpose of this project we're working on now? And the more times that workers could easily articulate what was the purpose of what we were doing today, the less instances of safety you would have, the less instances of quality, you know, non-conformities would you have, and you would overall have a more efficient and cleaner job site. Because when people are bought into a central purpose, they automatically take more care in what they're doing. And that could be take more care in being safe, take more care in delivering quality. And you see it all the time, right? Like, the military has mission statements, like, you know, people that are on in the U.S. Navy, like they're on an aircraft carrier, like they wear the hats with the silhouette of the ship, and then the I don't know if it's a serial number or whatever of the boat that they're on, but there's a pride and association with that boat, with that military unit. Like, this is known. This is stuff that organizations already do. And so, like, you know, for our line of work, like I'm really big on project teams. Like, hey, like, take the time, create a mission statement for your project. What do you mean a mission statement for my project? Yeah, like take the time to encourage your team to participate and do that. And then when you go out on site, like, hey, do you know the mission statement of this project? Yes, it's to, you know, deliver quality for, I don't know, the University of McGill and this soundstage that we're building, which is only one little room in a big building retrofit. But still, everybody working there knows what the purpose is. They're all bought into it. And I'm guaranteeing you, if you study those metrics across every project going on in North America, the ones where people know the purpose, you have less safety incidents and you have better quality at the end of the day, and probably a more efficient project. And if you really get granular into the data, like I bet you there's less requests for information, less site instructions. And it even goes back to, you know, ask your consultants, like, do you know what the purpose of this project is? And the more people answer yes and articulate it, the more those inefficiencies and wastes trend down. And that's what we need.
And you're talking about pride of ownership, right? You talked about the ship and the hat, right? The silhouette, and it's like the association and it becomes part of your identity, right? As you wear that outward facing garment, right? Having to be a hat, right? But it's like pride of ownership in your contribution to making the thing a reality. And I saw this comment on a YouTube video for somebody who's doing some education about the upcoming solar eclipse of all things. And the comment was, thank you so much for taking the time to make something for people that you will never meet. I thought that was so interesting. And that's what you're talking about with construction too, yeah. Right? You're making a product for people who you will likely never meet, but the thing that you're contributing to will affect them, and it can affect them negatively or it can affect them positively, right? And it's that kind of bigger picture thinking, I think, that actually is what drives me in my passion for architecture, is that architecture can change the world. It can change the way people interact with space. It can change their behavior and therefore their contribution back to society, right? In a positive way or a negative way. And of course, my goal would be that it always affects them in a positive way. How is that going to happen? By truly understanding, number one, like how that could happen. But number two, by delivering a great product so that they are taken care of and so that it does the things they need it to do, or it drives them to aspire to do what they do even better because they're in a place that lifts them up, right? To deliver that to somebody else, right? If it's patients or if it's children or coming into a school, right? It's like you can have a learning environment that is actually conducive to learning, or you can have something that's much more like a prison cell, right? Those are two viable options for a school classroom. We've seen examples of both of those, right? And so I going back to like just the overall image and the buy-in and the ownership that could be created, that there's so much potential here. How do we leverage that? How do we tell those stories to attract people to that so that we start getting more of that in these industries? That to me is really the crux of the question here. And who's willing to do that?
Well, we have to figure it out, right? Like we're running out of time to figure it out. Like you look at, so just speaking specifically for Canada, but I'm willing to say that the US is in the same boat, and probably all of the Western world for that matter. Like we don't have enough hospitals for our populations. We don't have enough homes for our populations. We don't have enough, military infrastructure for our populations. We don't have enough power generation for our populations. We have a climate crisis that, you know, needs these things solved. And what are we doing to really leverage the scarce resource of people that we have to realize those projects and get those things built? Like right now, we're doing the same thing we've been doing, which has been driving the efficiency graph. I keep banging on it, but driving that efficiency graph further into the ground. So like, yeah, agree. Like, let's all complain about it. Or let's, you know, it's what's the expression? It's better to light a candle than curse the dark. Like, so let's start lighting some candles. Let's start lighting some fires under people and get moving on something. Like start taking action, start working together instead of using our talents to work against each other. Because really that's what we're doing in a traditional contract model, is we're using everybody's expertise to work against each other and then build a project in the end. And I'm speaking, you know, in exaggerations, obviously, but some days it kind of feels like that.
Yeah. And I like how you point to potential solutions with IPD and even design build, right? Where it creates an environment for positive outcomes. And that's a choice that these companies can choose to participate in or not. Like, you could actually make the decision that we are only going to pursue these kinds of projects that have this delivery mechanism because they lead to better outcomes. And then you can be known for a company that creates better outcomes because of the systems that you've put in place to get there. Right? You don't have to participate in design, bid, build anymore. You don't have to, right? Yep. It's up to you. Nobody's making you do that, right? And so I think that there are ways to start to create the cultures that you're talking about that are less about de-risking, right? But shared risk going in together and changing the narrative around adversarial, no trust relationships between silos, right? And going into a model where we're all on the same team. There are ways to get, it's not like there's no hope, right? There are absolutely ways to do this. And on top of that, we have to find ways to tell these stories to young, impressionable people who are open to doing something different than maybe even what their parents are telling them is an acceptable vocation or profession to go into. I think that there are definitely, and it's not, you know, totally generalizing there, right, with the parent thing. But overall, it's we feel it. We see it. We keep seeing the reports on shortages for labor, for construction, but also for the architectural industry as well. So,
yeah, every aspect of it.
Right. Yeah, so I don't know if there's anything else that we're missing here, but I feel like this was a really productive conversation because bringing something to light that maybe not everybody knew was such a big issue is the construction industry has some sickness and so does the architecture industry as well. And figuring out ways to, I mean, the people listening to this show are probably already in the industry, but this might be a good one to share out with colleagues and with other people to understand how big this problem actually is, the challenges that are in front of us, because like no one else is going to solve this for us. It's up to us to take the responsibility to do that. I think this is where disruption is kind of a scary thing, right? Because you could have people coming from the outside and just saying, you're doing it wrong. Here's a better way to do it. And just eat our lunch for it. You know, I would rather be part of the solution than just saying, hey, there's a problem over here and I don't know what to do about it. So this to me has been a productive conversation and a good message to get out.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on and participating in this. And, you know, like, I just want to be really clear, right? Like, my criticisms of our industry, they come from a place of, like, I've been in this my whole life, right? So I'm not from the outside looking in. Like, I believe in what we're doing and I want to see it improve. And, there's a lane, there's a path we can do it. And if we work together, we'll get there.
Being critical is absolutely important, because you want it to get better. That's the whole point of what we call in architecture a crit, is to make the project better. We do critiques and we critique the work. It's not about the people as much. We want people to have a good time and good morale and enjoy what they're doing and even have a passion and a fire for it. But the goal is so that the thing gets better, right? And we see the problems and you're here helping to put those on display, but then also attempt to get us moving in a solution orientation.
Well, yeah, and you know, if you want to, without trying to sound too alarmist, right? Like our grandchildren and future generations are depending on us to start figuring these things out.
Yeah, I think that's an important perspective to have. Is it's not just about this project. It's not just about this week or this year. You're setting the stage for what's to come, right?
That's
and
right.
We should have that bigger picture view of where things are headed, because maybe it isn't your problem in 20 years. It's your problem now though, right? And you are contributing to the solution or the problem wherever you're at right now. And so I would hope that message like yours today on this show is really about being a part of the solution from wherever you are. That, you know, the whole idea of 360 degree leadership. You don't have to be a quote unquote leader to lead. Leadership is not appointed to you. It is a skill that you can develop from any position that you're in. And it is a constant battle, maybe not the right word, but it is a constant project to be looking at that and leading from wherever you are. So,
yeah, and I believe we have the best and brightest minds right in this industry that are capable of doing it. And once we start working together, we'll get there.
Yeah. Well, Jim, this has been a great conversation. I'll put links to where people can find you and connect with you. And I just wanted to say thank you, because I think it was 5 years ago. I mean, you were still at PCL when you first reached out to me at AU, I think just LinkedIn or something, and said, hey, want to grab a beer? Let's chat. And that was awesome. I mean, it's been great. So I appreciate you and everything that you've brought to this conversation today.
Yeah, you as well. Thanks for having the platform to be able to spread the gospel.
Awesome. Well, until the next AU, let's go ride bikes at the next one. And I learned that Jim's a fellow mountain biker, and we're going to have some fun at AU in San Diego this year. I hope so. That'll be fun. Yeah.
Can't wait.
All right. See you then.
See ya.
Thanks to our sponsors, and thanks to our members this week. Find out how you can become a member at trxl.co, and I'll talk to you again next week.